Coming up on This Week in Law, we have Ryan Kahlo, Ryan Davidson, and James Daly. We'll be talking about surveillance, facial recognition, robots, artificial intelligence, a number of things having to do with the investigation of the Boston Marathon bombing. And we'll be talking about why you shouldn't film yourself getting drunk and posting that online if you're driving. All of that next, coming up on TWIL.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWIL, This Week in Law, episode 207, recorded April 19th, 2013. Bad Robots. This episode of TWIL is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with ShareFile by Citrix. Try ShareFile today. For a 30-day free trial, go to ShareFile.com, click the radio microphone, and enter TWIL. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 207 of This Week in Law. I'm Evan Brown, standing in for Denise this week. She is away. So I'm holding down the fort and looking forward to a really interesting conversation this week. You know, it's been, a pretty bizarre week, that's for sure. One of the most bizarre weeks in news and, you know, maybe in U.S. history, certainly in recent memory. So plenty of issues that kind of can underlie some of the discussion that we can have, and we'll get into that. But let me introduce you to our panel. First, welcome back to the show, Ryan Kahlo. Ryan's a professor at the University of Washington. How's it going, Ryan?
It's going really well. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, great. It's great to have you back. Looking forward to talking with you. Another Ryan on the show, Ryan Davidson, coming to us from Fort Wayne, Indiana, right? Is that where you are, Ryan Davidson?
For the moment, that's correct. Good to be here.
Yes, yeah. And Ryan Davidson, along with your colleague, I guess you would put it, James Daly. Hi, James.
Hi.
And the two of you write Law in the Multiverse, a very interesting blog talking about a number of issues, theoretical and real, that deal with superheroes, robotics, all kinds of hypothetical things. So looking forward to talking to you about some of the issues that you've written about recently and some other interesting things as they come up here. For those of you watching live on video right now and watching after the fact, for that matter, I apologize for the sluggishness, the jitteriness of my video. I'm not sure what the issue is here. So I hope that together we can not be too distracted about that and have a good conversation nonetheless. So, yeah, as I was alluding to at the beginning, it's been a really weird week. Several stories, each of which would, significant in their own right. You know, of course, the bombing in Boston at the Boston Marathon on Monday, the ricin scare. You know, this guy from Mississippi is alleged to have sent ricin-laced correspondence to a senator and also to President Obama. CISPA passed the House, that legislation that's really threatens or could threaten our Fourth Amendment privacy rights. There was the big explosion at the fertilizer plant in Texas, you know, at least 12 people dead from that. There's been flooding here in Chicago that's closed schools for 2 days, and the Chicago River is actually moving in the right direction. You know, early in the 20th century, they reversed the flow for pollution reasons. Now it's actually going back into Lake Michigan like nature intended. There's a big earthquake in Iran and Pakistan. The gun control bill failed in the Senate. A lot of outrage about that. Pat Summerall died, for sports fans. So, you know, where are the good old days of last week when we were only worried about, nuclear war with Korea? So it's been an interesting week and, you know, certainly some things that we can talk about with that. In the news this morning, where we are now with the Boston bombing thing is, of course, yesterday afternoon, the FBI released photos of the two suspects, and there was the big shootout during the night. One of the suspects is now dead, and the other guy is on the run. At least that's where we are now. That news is likely to change in the time that we're on the show here now. So one of the big things, one of the big factors in the identification of these suspects and the way in which the FBI communicated this information yesterday was through the use of surveillance video, apparently from I know that earlier in the week there was talk about Lord and Taylor had in Boston had a surveillance video camera set up. And Ryan Kahlo, I wonder if you'd be willing to comment what the significance of this is in relation to our privacy rights. And, you know, how would you address the difference between how we should think about our privacy rights in public surveillance like this in the interest that we have in tracking down bad guys like we are here in tracking down the guys who are responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing. How would you comment on that?
Sure. So the fact that there was video of the suspects from Lord and Taylor or wherever the source happened to have been, you know, it reminds us that there is a lot of surveillance of public in public these days. But also it reminds us that that surveillance is largely atomized, meaning that it's not as though we are living in London where there are a bunch of cameras belonging to the government that are all linked together, at least not everywhere, right? So, there's either talk or actual deployment of linked government cameras in certain cities. But in general, you know, a lot of it's atomized. And so it's ATM cameras. It's cameras that have a purpose that is really, you know, rather limited, you know, limited usually to loss prevention, security, vandalism at a small scale. And what that permits is that after the fact, when there's been a terrible tragedy, when there's something specific to investigate, the government is then able to access that video footage if it needs to, as long as it does it in a timely way. So that it's not destroyed, because often these places have data retention policies where they destroy video after a certain amount of time. I think that the impulse will be, you know, gosh, we found these suspects through video. We ought to put video everywhere. We ought to put video cameras all over the place, because that will somehow permit us to, I'm not sure, right? So in a sense, the fact that we actually do have these people on footage means that the system is working reasonably well. And so I think that the only thing else we could have done would be to prevent the tragedy by having cameras in place. But, you know, I've never seen very convincing evidence that having cameras on everywhere all the time can actually stop this kind of tragedy from occurring, because think about what you'd have to do. I mean, you'd have to, in real time, somehow monitor people, flag that they're suspicious. I'm not aware that these two particular perpetrators were ever on anyone's radar, so it wasn't like we had pictures of them or were looking for them that I know of. It would be an enormous logistical challenge to try to leverage ubiquitous surveillance by the government. And meanwhile, that would present a lot of dangers that would accompany ubiquitous government surveillance, coupled with, you know, facial recognition and so forth. And so in a sense, it's like it's worked for investigative purposes. I'm not sure it's an argument for greater deployment of surveillance for prophylactic purposes.
Do you think that it's always going to remain so atomized, though? Just, you know, less than a month ago, Mayor Bloomberg on a radio show, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City, was essentially dismissing the fact that 5 years from now, there could be surveillance cameras on every corner. People shouldn't be worried about this being Big Brother. Just get on with it. I'm wondering if the change would the concerns that we have about this would change if it's not so atomized. If there is unification and a combination with, you know, the combination of more cameras plus big data analysis to kind of generate meaning from this information in real time, would that change the impact it has on our privacy concerns at all, Ryan Kahlo?
Sort of Bloomberg is the new, McNeely, right? Privacy is dead, get over it. I think that people are always announcing the death of privacy. It seems like every headline you read, every blog post, comes up with a new, and I'm guilty of this myself, comes up with a new technology and says, okay, now privacy is dead. It never fully dies. And part of that has to do with the fact that it's a value that we really care about. Sometimes we have difficulty articulating the harm. Sometimes we have difficulty balancing privacy as against other interests like security. It never totally goes away. And so the idea that anyone's going to just sort of quote unquote get over it, as the mayor intimated, and as you know, was it Sun Microsystems, a guy did years ago? It strikes me as factually inaccurate. I mean, look at the pushback that we've gotten over the domestic use of drones. That has really captured the public imagination, and now states are moving to legislate. And then there have been a couple of states already that have moved to legislate. And in fact, there's federal legislation that may be introduced going forward. People can say anything. I can sit here and say, we'll never allow linked cameras in our cities, and there will be a privacy revolution. So what? So I said it. The truth of the matter is that you will see. And if history is any example, there will be points of pushback. And it's not necessarily an inexorably all-in-one-direction expansion of surveillance. And in fact, some of the recent surveillance technologies that have developed, like drones, have been all the more visceral and have elicited sort of a return to hardware. So actually eliciting more of a reaction than some of the developments that have preceded it. So, I don't agree with the mayor, even as a predictive matter, although I think that things like the Boston bombing will make many think that that's the right move.
James, what do you think about this question of the risk to our privacy from having more surveillance? Are you concerned that there's privacy protections that we have that are eroding away here, especially with the sensibilities that might change because of the greater fear of terrorism?
Well, I think that cameras, widespread cameras, are a great investigative tool. The fact that everybody walks around with a camera and nowadays in their pocket, or at least the vast majority of people do, I think, and the fact that many stores, or most stores, I think, have surveillance cameras and that kind of thing, it's a great investigative tool after the fact. But as you point out, it's just almost impossible beforehand to use them as a preventative way. And it's just statistics. The prior probability that any given person is up to no good is very, very, very low. But after the fact, once you know that a crime has occurred in a particular place, then sure, it's much, much easier to then concentrate your investigative efforts in a particular place and comb through that much, much, much smaller bit of evidence and to find suspects. And that's exactly what we saw in Boston. The idea of looking everywhere across the entire country all the time continuously for some kind of suspicious behavior, the number of false positives that you turn up would make it completely unmanageable, and the problem of false positives, I think, is the bigger problem to me than the privacy issue as such, because in public places, for example, we already don't really have a reasonable expectation of privacy. If you have cameras that are pointed at public streets and public plazas and that kind of thing, you already don't have much of privacy as it is. So, as a practical matter, people sort of think that they don't need to be recorded all the time or shouldn't be recorded all the time, but really when push comes to shove, they could be. But I think the real issue with that kind of pervasive surveillance would be that what would happen is that there would be a lot of false positives. Those people would be investigated, and there'd be it would amount to their lives would be upended, and even and then there would be the problem of a lot of them, they would eventually be exonerated, but some would necessarily there would be sort of convincing false positives where. They would be the innocent people who ended up being found guilty even so, or who had to really, really work hard in order to exonerate themselves. And that would be, to me, the even bigger problem to taking that kind of approach. So yeah, widespread use of cameras, great after the fact. Boston shows that. But I think, yeah, taking it one step further and saying we should turn it into a panopticon surveillance, you know, active surveillance state kind of thing, that I think that, yeah, there's a big drawbacks.
Ryan Davidson, want to get your comments on that, on what James was saying about false positives. You know, I was engaged in a conversation on Twitter yesterday about this very thing, because I put up a tweet saying this is where the rubber meets the road when it comes to balancing our privacy interests and facial recognition databases that law enforcement have. You know, that in a time like this, when you've got photos of a suspect, wouldn't it be nice just to run that by some database and, you know, figure out immediately who they are? I mean, in this situation, it's only taken 12 hours after the release of the information to, you know, make some real progress on tracking the guys down. But one of the responses that I got in that conversation on Twitter is, you know, this very issue that James is raising. What about the false positives? And the question that I would have for you is that enough of a reason to not really be progressive when it comes to the use of these technologies, more surveillance, more use of facial recognition, given the fact that there have been false positives before, that there are false positives now just by having, you know, somebody use their eyes to look at something? You know, the perfect example who he has come up a lot this week is Richard Jewell from 1996, you know, who was falsely accused of bombing the Olympic Park in Atlanta in 1996. That was a false positive. Yeah, it was not a false identification. But what do you think about the impact of false positives and how it should relate to the use of technology to do surveillance like this?
Well, I think what this really does is just get back to the sort of age-old issue of eyewitness testimony. Any number of people are convicted of serious felonies every day of the week based primarily or even sometimes exclusively on eyewitness testimony. And there's very, very good research that shows that it is possibly the least reliable form of evidence out there, particularly as we get farther and farther from the event we're talking about. But everyone knows this. But the courts have shown remarkably little interest in doing anything about it. We have this sort of inherent sense that it's an eyewitness. Everyone trusts their own senses, right? Well, you can think of this as sort of an expansion of eyewitness testimony. Now, not only do we have our own sort of faulty memories to rely on, we have these cameras out there which are recording some of that. Now, in one sense, that might help because it isn't just our own memories we're relying on. We now have a digital record. David Lynch had things to say about this in some of his films. But there's still the question of identification. So we have this picture. What does it mean? What does it say? There's been a joke going around the internet now that, you know, we're basing our identification of these two guys as wearing hats. Well, I'm glad we're not in the 1950s, because wearing a white hat and a black hat doesn't really tell us very much about anybody. And right now, it looks pretty likely that the suspects that have been identified probably were involved. But they may not have been. We don't know. I certainly don't from where I'm sitting, and I've seen a lot of this footage. So I think it's a real problem. But I think it's kind of a piece with a lot of problems that are already out there that we seem to have basically decided that we're not going to deal with. We know eyewitness testimony is unreliable, that it's incredibly unreliable. But what are our alternatives?
Ryan Kahlo, you wrote a piece for CNN last month where you said that we're missing out on the transformative potential of drones, you know, this transformative potential that drones have, and also said that rather than seeing an end to drones, you'd rather see an end to bad privacy. I'm wondering if you're willing to talk about any of the nuances that would attach to the situation where if there had been a drone flying over the finish line at the Boston Marathon capturing images of suspects, and how that relates to this transformative potential that you talk about. Is there anything to be said about that?
I remember that the president of the trade association, AUVSI, maintained in the wake, in the immediate wake of the Boston bombing, that had we had a drone available to respond, then somehow that would have improved the situation in some way. And he was basically sort of pilloried for using the event as a form of self-promotion. And perhaps what he said was not in the best timing or the best taste, but it's not untrue that had law enforcement had a drone on hand, it's conceivable that they would have had an additional tool that would have helped them respond to the emergency, whether it was because they could have located people or because it would have helped them coordinate the evacuation of the area and so forth. Then it's probably right that they would have benefited from that tool in some way. I think, again, for all the reasons we've been talking about, and I couldn't agree more with my co-panelists here, that having a drone just sort of flying around looking for things in advance probably would not have done much more than what Bruce Schneier accurately calls security theater. It would be very difficult to, even with the drone, to be able to find people that you don't know mean you any harm that are wearing hats and backpacks, and to figure out that those particular people are going to set off more than one bomb. That would be next to impossible. So to the extent anyone's suggesting that had we had drones, somehow we would have been able to prevent the tragedy, that strikes me as obviously not right. That said, you know, the transformative potential of drones goes well beyond using them for prophylactic surveillance. I mean, not only can you support the police in appropriate circumstances like emergencies, but in addition, you have agricultural uses that do not implicate surveillance in quite the same way. You have interesting novel commercial uses like extreme sport photography, photographing wildlife animals. You have the ability to go after polluters potentially. You can cover the news. I mean, there's lots and lots of things that you can do with these technologies that are potentially really useful, and in the end, maybe transformative. And you know, I think we should be able to go forward with that. But I do think that it's just a shame how inadequate privacy law is at the most fundamental level to deal with the nuances that drones and other surveillance technologies create, such as the binary conception of public and private, as though somehow by being in public, you give up any semblance of privacy. And so that's starting to unravel, but it's doing it so slowly. I think the Jones decision in the United States v. Jones decision last year signaled a willingness on the part of at least five justices to re-examine the idea that you have no expectation of privacy in public. I think that the Jardines case, the dog sniffing case, was problematic, although I would say that I'm surprised we're not talking more about dog sniffing, because that's something that actually you could have prophylactically prevented this problem by having widespread use of dogs. That is something that, I mean, I don't know if it would have for sure, but it at least as a more plausible scenario than if you had cameras everywhere. And so that's something we really need to take very seriously. Under what circumstances are we prepared to back off from a constitutional perspective on the use of things like dogs or chemical sensors that are capable of detecting bombs? I think that's a much, much harder question than is there no expectation of privacy in public. And I'm sorry to sort of go off on a tangent, but it occurs to me that that's an interesting angle.
Well, that is an interesting angle. And I'm wondering if there's any, you know, real merit in trying to speculate where this could go, this prophylactic use of high technology, surveillance technologies, facial recognition, stuff like that. You know, as these technologies get more advanced, whether there's any concern that we should have over where this may be 10 years from now. What I'm envisioning is a drone and not necessarily like, you know, the model airplane kind of drone that I think most people think of when they conjure up the picture of one in one's mind. Not like, you know, flies over Afghanistan and Pakistan, but, you know, maybe even a very small device that's going around here, you know, is what is you know, what kind of concerns should we have? What risks should we see for ourselves when a drone could be equipped with facial recognition technology, for example, that's constantly scanning faces and querying a private database or public database, looking for something here? I guess the essential point would be, or the essential amalgamation of the issues would be, what do we do someday when a drone could be as effective in ferreting things out as a contraband sniffing dog? Anything along those lines worth being concerned about?
You're asking, okay. So there are two distinct precedents that we're talking about. One of them says that you have no expectation of privacy in public that society is prepared to accept as reasonable. That is the CATS test as applied to public spaces. And that's going to be primarily the conversation around things like facial recognition in public. And there the danger is that, and by the way, I think it was James already alluded to this. There the danger is that, or apologies if it was Ryan, but is that it's going to just be excessive. I mean, you'd be scanning everybody's space, keeping a log of everybody's whereabouts, so that on occasion, very, very rarely, maybe you'll have a better shot at identifying people who mean to do us harm. It doesn't feel like a cost-benefit analysis that comes out in favor of widespread surveillance. The precedent having to do with chemical sniffing or dog sniffing is a different line of cases. And those cases don't say that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in public. What they say is that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in contraband, no matter where it is, including, incidentally, if it's in your house. Because the Jardines case that was just before the Supreme Court this term, the case was decided on the basis of the fact that there was a trespass in order to get the dog onto your property. They didn't tangle with the longstanding notion that if a dog alerts to something that's contraband, you cannot then turn around and claim constitutional protection because society is not prepared to accept as reasonable your subjective expectation of privacy in contraband. So the idea then would be that dogs or drones with chemical sensors that are analogous to dogs would be flying around looking for bombs. They're not keeping a log of all our whereabouts. They're not taking pictures of us. They're only alerting, supposedly, in the presence of something that you're not allowed to have in public, like a bomb. And so it's quite seductive, that line of reasoning. This comes from Cabales and from Place and from Edmondson and Jacobson. You know, Edmonds and Jacobson, these are a line of cases, all of which hold that if all the technology or animal does is say yes or no to something that you're not allowed to have anyway, one wonders why you shouldn't be able to have it. And so I'm surprised we're not talking about why in big events like this one, the government is not putting up dogs everywhere, chemical sniffers everywhere. That would be something that I think that the Supreme Court would find was not only not a problem, but doesn't even register constitutionally. It's not even a search for constitutional purposes. Now, what's the danger of that? You know, false positives is the danger. Expanding the list of things that are contraband beyond, beyond bombs is problematic. Like, so what if what they're sniffing for is not just bombs, but like, marijuana? What if they're sniffing for just things we wouldn't, at one point the Motion Picture Association of America paid to have dogs trained to detect the telltale sign of a newly printed CD to help combat copyright violations, right? How much pressure can we put on this, on the Cabalist line of cases? That to me strikes me as a distinct and extremely difficult question, one where I'm not even necessarily sure how I come out.
Yeah, I mean, it's one's left to wonder whether the fallout of this is going to be something like what you're talking about, dogs everywhere trying to detect chemicals, in much the same way after 9/11 we saw much more increased airport security and stuff like that. But Ryan Kahlo, I know you need to to get off the line here and get back to your job of being a professor at the University of Washington. Any final comments along these lines? Because it's left with James and the other Ryan here for us to continue the conversation and all the things that are going on here. Any final comments? Anything you want to plug? Anything before you sign off?
No, I mean, I just want to say that, first of all, I intend, when I have a chance, this weekend, to watch the remainder of the show, because it's so interesting to me, and the people that are on are so interesting. And so I'm sorry to have to hop off now, but I intend to come back and revisit the show. The second thing I would say, and I suppose this is on one level a plug, we had a big conference last week that folks might be interested in at Stanford. That's called We Robot, Getting Down to Business. It's the second inaugural Robotics in the Law conference. The first was at Miami, and the conference returns to Miami next year. And we have a bunch of papers and eventually videos of that conference and a lot of news coverage of it if people are interested in the subject of robotics in the law, which we only touched upon in passing. But so basically, check out the conference if you're interested. I look forward to watching the rest of this show this weekend. Thanks a lot.
Hey, well, thanks for being here. Ryan Kahlo, everyone. So, all right, James, Ryan Davidson, we have the time together, the three of us here to talk about some issues. For those listeners who aren't familiar yet, James, tell us about Law in the Multiverse. What is that?
Well, Law in the Multiverse is a blog that I started in November of 2010, and Ryan came on board very shortly after I started it. We explain legal principles with examples drawn primarily from comic books, but also from other popular media, like movies and TV shows. And it's a great, fun way to talk about and explore those fictional universes, and also kind of a fun way to talk about and explore the law.
Ryan, what is kind of your focus when it comes to thinking about these issues with the law of superheroes and other things? What things do you find most intriguing?
I've always sort of been a fan of legal history. So those issues which let me dig back into the way things used to be are a lot of fun. I wrote a post very early on about the common law sentence of outlawry and discuss it as it might apply to supervillains in the modern context. And in a more practical sense, we're starting to see a little bit of that as it comes to the discussion of the resurgence in international piracy. These bad actors that seem to be outside the range of national governments that we're still dealing with somehow. In my day jobs, I've spent a lot of time dealing with insurance and posts about civil liability, tort liability, insurance regulation and coverage. Those things have been interesting to me as we've written.
Well, that might be an interesting segue into the question of who should be responsible if a robot does something harmful to someone else. What do you think, Ryan? Where should civil liability apply if somebody's robot goes out and tries to destroy the world?
This sounds to me like a fairly standard products liability case. We have an instrumentality which is made by a manufacturer or someone. It may have been purchased by a party down the market stream somewhere, and it goes out and someone is injured as a result.
Go ahead.
So we chase the chain of liability back through the person who was using the robot at the time, then maybe back to the manufacturer, see if there was a defect along there somewhere. And just like any other instrumentality, if you injure someone, if you own something that injures someone else, it's probably going to be liability in there somewhere.
If robotics, let me ask you, James, if robotics progresses, the science progresses so much that someday robots are completely autonomous. And even though they originally have been created by human beings, they maybe have passed some kind of line where they are conscious, where they can actually make their own decisions and perhaps come to some sense of responsibility for their own actions. This is a very fundamental question in the law of robotics and these types of things. Is there a point at which we can stop with the products liability framework that Ryan is talking about and go more toward individual liability, culpability to this intelligent agent that has been created?
Well, maybe. It's a little hard when talking about robots because there actually haven't as far as I've been able to tell, the last time I looked was a few months ago, but fairly recently. I've not actually been able to see any cases specifically about liability for injuries caused by robots. And by robots, I mean like industrial robots or Roombas or something like that, you know, the actual kinds of robots that that exist today. So there doesn't seem to be much in the way of robot law. So it's hard to even gauge where the courts even begin to see this kind of issue. As far as something like holding the robot accountable on a criminal basis or a civil basis, I guess, there's a couple of questions. If you think about it at a civil level, well, then you have to – what assets does the robot have? That approach really only works if the robot isn't judgment-proof. I mean, it does nobody any good if we say, oh, no, it's the robot's fault. Let the robot pay. Well, the robot is broke, so that doesn't do anybody any good. Then the whole issue depends on whether or not the robot is a person. The robot has rights and responsibilities. Again, not a lot of cases about this with regard to robots. A few cases, however, with regard to animals, and including some circuit court cases, or at least one circuit court case, and a handful of district court cases, with some people trying to sue on behalf of cetaceans, primarily, so like dolphins and whales and things, trying to say that they should have standing to sue for injuries done to them. That is to say that the cetaceans should have standing to sue on their own for themselves. That is to say that rather than the humans having to bring a lawsuit to say, no, don't do this thing that is harming the whales, that the whales would bring the lawsuit in their own name and then the humans would simply be their representative in court. It's like if someone hurts a young child or someone who is mentally disabled. The lawsuit is brought by the child or the mentally disabled person. They simply have a representative in court because, of course, they can't actually manage their own affairs yet. And the court held that while it was within Congress's power to extend standing to animals if it wanted to, theoretically, that would be such an extraordinary departure from the way things have been done ever. It would require a very, very explicit statement from Congress. And it certainly would be something that Congress would have to do rather than something that the courts could do on their own. That was what the Ninth Circuit said. So I think that we would probably take the same approach with robots where it would have to be something that the legislature did. And they would have to very carefully craft some kind of standard for robot personhood, and it would be very difficult because it's, you know, even today people disagree even as a theoretical matter what would be a good way to define conscious or responsible or aware or sentient or intelligent or whatever, and it's difficult because should that even be the standard? Because of course that's not the standard for people. A person who is born with a severe mental disability still has all of the same rights as any other person, except in as much as because of their disability they might, have a guardian appointed for them or something like that. But they're still a legal person. So if you have a robot that is capable, is intelligent and has all these things, all these rights, once you have one robot that has these rights, well, shouldn't all other robots have these rights? Aren't they just arguably mentally disabled or something? It's very tricky. It becomes very philosophical, and I don't know that the law is very well equipped at this point to grapple with those issues. I think it lacks a very good framework for it, and I think it needs a lot of philosophical underpinning before a good legal framework could then come out of it.
Right. Ryan, I know in one of your blog posts, you talked about this cetacean case, cetaceans being the whales and the porpoises and the other marine mammals, and the Ninth Circuit held that it didn't have standing. to bring suit for injuries. I think it had to do with the naval use of sonar, right? And so, I mean, is that an effective line for us to argue when it comes to the responsibilities that non-human intelligent agents may have? Because standing is a right, and it's kind of the converse of an obligation. Is that, I guess I would be interested in hearing you talk about why we think that if the court is going to set up certain frameworks for standing, the legal right to sue, why that would be the same kind of analysis that would go toward whether or not it had the responsibility of not acting in a way that is criminal or in a way that violates civil common law, like, for example, being negligent or something like that. What's the relationship between standing and the obligation for liability?
Well, I think the issue here is fundamentally capacity, in the legal sense of the term, which is the ability to both sue and to be sued. I don't think there's any entity ever that's had the capacity to do only one of those things. If you can sue someone, you can also be sued by that person or anyone else for that matter. And as I was thinking about this, I did a series of several posts on non-human intelligences. There's an entire chapter in our book on the subject. I came to the conclusion that legislatures and probably the courts as well are likely to draw a fairly bright line between biological non-human intelligences and artificial non-human intelligences. Human beings are people. There's not a whole lot of question as to what constitutes a human being. Here we are. We haven't gotten technically to the point that there's any real fuzziness about that. If another biological entity came along and started talking to us and basically asked to be treated as a legal person, it would be very difficult to tell them no. You know, here's something that, even though it isn't strictly human, in many senses is very similar to us. They have a body. They have intelligence, whatever that means. They can certainly communicate with us. If something like that showed up and presented itself to the courts, what are they going to do? Say, no, we're sorry. Anyone can shoot you who wants to because you're not a human? That could be a really, really hard sell. On the other hand, robots seem to be fundamentally different. You know, artificial intelligences run in software on hardware. Some people try and draw a metaphor between the human mind and the human body, but we don't have any idea how that works. And the difference between a human and a robot is that you can turn a robot completely off and then later turn it back on again, and the robot will be fine. You can't do that with people. When a human being, when its metabolic processes stop, that's the end of it. And you can't copy us. You can copy robots. If artificial intelligences are software, they can be copied. Are we now having multiple instances of these people running around? How many of them can we cram into a single PC? Is it involuntary servitude to ask them to do things for us? You know, is it unconstitutional to issue commands on a command line now? This seems way too messy and way too counterintuitive. There is something intuitive about recognizing the legal personhood of a biological non-human intelligence. But there's some very, very counterintuitive results that come along when we start treating artificial entities as being legal persons. So I think that's likely to be a point of interest should this issue ever find its way into the honest-to-goodness legal system.
Some of listeners may be seeking MCLE credit for this, and it's our obligation to give a passphrase at this point to prove that you were listening to the show and that you were not robotically taking it all in. Let's make our first passphrase non-human intelligence. So James, Ryan, just to stay on that point, could we say, I mean, is it a line that we could draw that we would extend these rights and obligations on a, I guess you would say, at a substrate specific basis, humans, biological substrates for the computation that goes on in having a mind and consciousness versus something else? Or were you actually saying something different than that?
I think close to that. I guess I would be resistant to the mind as computer metaphor. It's a useful metaphor, but it is just a metaphor. And the idea that the brain makes calculations, we can talk that way. Is that what's really happening? I'm not sure that we know that, and certainly not in any way that we could represent in a series of logic gates as we do in computers. But I do think that drawing a distinction between biological entities and non-biological entities is a bright line that the courts and legislatures could get their head around and would be very, very easy to enforce. And I'm of the opinion that this would run along most people's intuitions about these things.
James, if we are to give rights and obligations to non-human intelligent agents, is it conceivable then that they should have a constitutional due process and, more importantly, perhaps an equal protection status?
Well, I think so. I think that once you've made something a person, then they're a person. I think so. I think it would be really, really dicey to try to create like a second class citizen scheme for non-human intelligences and things. I think we've been down that road before, and it doesn't go anywhere good. I think that if history is any guide, then the way to do it would be to say that they are, you know, on an equal basis with humans as much as is at all practical. I think that wouldn't be pretty necessary. There's been some interesting questions in the Twitter stream, the IRC, the chat room. I don't know if we want to respond to those about this topic.
Yeah, what do you want to talk about?
Somebody said something about their dog having rights, and I wanted to say that that is a point. It's an interesting point. I'm sorry to say that your dog actually does not have rights. We don't have an animal rights model in the United States. We have an animal welfare or animal protection model, and that's the case in most of the world. So when we talk about the case in the Ninth Circuit, that was an attempt to bring the United States into an animal rights model where the animals themselves would have rights the way people have rights. Instead, animals have laws that protect them, but if those laws are violated, it's not that the dog or the animal can bring a suit in response to that violation. Instead, the state brings a suit, or the owner brings a suit, or the state brings a criminal case. Seems like a fine distinction. Like, well, who cares? Who cares who brings the suit? Like, the point is that the wrongdoer is punished or whatever. But I think for some legal theorists and animal rights proponents, I guess it's pretty important. Strictly speaking, we don't have animal rights in the United States. We only have animal welfare or animal protection laws.
Yes, animals are a species of property.
Yeah. Another point was somebody had mentioned about animal trials in the medieval era, and that's true. There were animal trials where an animal would cause an injury to a human, and then there would be or to property, and then they would be put on trial, and if they were found guilty, they might be executed or whatever. And those did happen, but the way to think about that is not that the animal was being held legally responsible or was considered to have legal responsibilities in the same way that people did. Really, it was more akin to or a predecessor to what we consider, what we would call today, an in rem action, an action where the jurisdiction was over the thing and rather than over a person. If you look up, there's a fun Wikipedia article about a list of in rem, it's REM, like the band, case names. And yeah, there you go. And it's the really fun names, like United States versus $64,000 in cash or whatever. Or United States versus so many bottles of Coca-Cola. They've got really fun names.
1971 Cadillac or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same kind of thing today where, strictly speaking, the case is brought against something, some physical thing. And sometimes they involve animals. And it's not that we think that the Cadillac or the bottles of Coca-Cola are guilty of a crime, but that's what the jurisdiction is based on. And ultimately, if the result might be that the physical thing is forfeited to the government, and if it's contraband, may in fact ultimately be destroyed. So, you know, in some cases, it's not entirely unlike those medieval animal trials. So anyway, it's kind of a bit of a digression, but yeah, so those trials were a real thing, but I don't think that they really indicated that people considered the animals to be on par with people or to have responsibility, legal responsibility for their actions in quite the way one might think.
There's right, another question about transgenic animals. You know, how much human DNA can a pig have before it starts to have rights? We're not basing in the legal system anymore. We're not basing the definition of personhood on the existence of DNA. It's nothing so technical. It's a pretty much a common sense realism definition of humanity. Do you look like a human? Can you talk like a human? Do we recognize you as being a person? There isn't any strict legal definition for this. You're either a human or you're not. So adding human DNA to a pig wouldn't actually make that a person any more than adding genetically engineered or non-human DNA to a person to treat a disease. That isn't the kind of metaphysics we're dealing with here.
Guys, hold those thoughts briefly. We've got to take a quick break to say a word about our sponsor for episode 207. Of This Week in Law. This episode is brought to you by ShareFile. It's not only what we do at work, but how we do it that makes the difference. Our flow of information needs to be ongoing, collaborative, and time efficient, whether we're working at the office or on the go. ShareFile helps you do all that easily and securely. ShareFile by Citrix seamlessly integrates into your daily routine, no matter where you are, from any mobile device. With ShareFile, files of almost any size are sent as secure links. Notifications are sent to you when they're open to track their progress. Files can be password protected for ultimate control. Plus, you can set up shared folders for easy collaboration with clients and coworkers. ShareFile will change the way you work. To help you get started, they have a special 30-day free trial offer, no obligation, and you'll see the difference right away. To get this special offer, go to ShareFile.com today. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter TWIL, T-W-I-L. That's ShareFile.com and enter TWIL. James, so could a robot ever vote in a presidential election?
Well, I think that would really depend on some of the other issues that we talked about earlier about, you know, not only personhood, but then a citizenship and then, you know, reaching the appropriate voting age and all the other appropriate requirements for voting. So, you know, I guess we talked about the possibility of holding them criminally liable for their actions. So in some states, I guess they would have to not be a felon. And that kind of thing. So, I think it's certainly possible. That's one of the things about the law is that it's ultimately sort of, whatever we decide to make of it. So I suppose it's, imaginable. When we talk about robots, I think that is something that helps a little bit with Ryan's earlier objection to some of the problems with artificial intelligences, where a robot at least constrains the artificial intelligence to a single entity, and that physical entity, and that helps a little bit some of those objections. And so I think maybe. One problem is that, of course, we might find ourselves in a situation where the robots live a lot longer than humans do, and theoretically they could start to end up being a majority of the population just by the accumulation of their numbers, which, you know, that's just democracy for you, I guess. But I suppose if they could vote, we could find ourselves in a situation where humans were the minority, and suddenly we have a robot Congress and a robot president. I think so. I think that's certainly possible. Now, I think when it comes to something like expanding the definition of something like citizenship, that might require not just an act of Congress. That's something like that might require a constitutional amendment. I'm not sure. That's not something that I've looked into quite as much as some of the other topics.
Right.
And yeah, I agree with James. It might require that. Until it comes along, I'm not sure we'll ever know. It's just such an enormous sea change for what the legal system is and how it works to start talking about expanding the definition of legal personhood beyond humans.
Yeah, I was kind of puzzled as to why a age requirement would be necessary for a non-human intelligence to vote. I mean, if these things are programmed, you could. I guess the premise for an age requirement to vote is, you know, the experience that comes with age, the cognitive development that comes with that to make a good decision as to who to vote for, you know, sane judgment, all of those things which conceivably could be created as emergent properties the very moment of having been programmed. So I'm wondering, James, if that constitutional amendment you were talking about would do away with that age requirement for those types of intelligences and replace it with some other proxy for good judgment.
Well, I mean, I suppose it could be done, but then do we really want the government to administer some kind of good judgment test before you're allowed to vote? Because that seems like the sort of thing that could potentially, I mean, that just seems like an enormous quagmire, because the possibility of the test basically being a proxy for who you're going to vote for, or, you know, trying to tease apart any possible correlation between the test and who you might vote for would be just a really big mess. And then, I don't know. I mean, you know, as I say, theoretically anything's possible with an amendment, I guess. But that just seems like shades of literacy tests and all kinds of things that we've. You know, again, I don't know that we want to have second-class citizenship treatment if we were going to do something like that. This just seems like, you know, historically it just hasn't worked out very well. And if we really truly had intelligent, conscious, really on par with human beings in pretty much every way, artificial intelligences, I don't know that they would stand for being treated any differently.
How would we measure the age of an AI? Is this uptime?
Is it when the program
first published?
Yeah.
Every time it patches itself?
Who knows? It would depend so much on how it worked. It would be really hard to say.
You think it would be unconstitutional and probably some kind of civil rights violation to require it to, at a minimum, pass a Turing test to have these rights, or to vote, to get married, to get a driver's license. Well, that's self-driving cars. That may be sooner.
Well, certainly as it stands today, you can't do that for humans. I mean, the mentally disabled do not have are not really a protected class in the same way as some other groups. But nonetheless, I think that I think that there were like broadly systemic discrimination against them, where, for example, to do just about everything, you had to, you know, pass an IQ test. I think that the court would probably revisit that issue. I think, was that DeShaney? No, that wasn't DeShaney. I can't remember the name of the case, but the case that about the whether or not the mentally disabled were a suspect classification or something. I think that would be an issue. A lot of people in the IRC thing, and you mentioned, I've been mentioning it as well, and you also mentioned the Turing test. I have a couple of degrees in computer science, and I could just say that the Turing test is sort of a very popular notion about, oh, well, we have this thing that this very, very brilliant guy, Alan Turing, sort of came up with about a possible way to determine whether or not an artificial intelligence is really intelligent or not. Actually, it has a lot of flaws and probably is not as much of a gold standard perfect way to tell whether or not an artificial intelligence is equivalent to a human as a practical matter as people might think. So I don't know if it's as simple a matter as people might think to say, oh, well, we just say if they can pass the Turing test, then they're good. And in any case, it's still the same problem of you're saying that for some reason artificial intelligences and robots have to effectively pass a pretty high in test of intelligence and reasoning and be conversant and think on their feet and sociability and all these things that are very implicit in the Turing test that human beings just don't. A human being could totally fail the Turing test and still be able to get a driver's license and be a safe driver at that, and get a perfectly good job that would pay a living wage, live independently, all these things, make reasonable decisions voting in election, yada yada yada. My point is that not only would I think such a test, whatever kind of test it might be, probably not be a great idea from a legal point of view and probably cause a lot of issues, I don't know that it even makes a lot of sense, because we don't really allow them for humans, and I think for good reason.
Mm-hmm. Let's switch gears a little bit.
Never mind.
No, why don't you go finish that up?
Sure. It up, Brian. I think this sort of comes back to the earlier bright line rule I suggested, that there's a categorical difference in kind between artificial entities and biological entities. If a biological entity exists and any of the members of the class seem to be and act like persons, we sort of recognize that they all are. But how do we even draw that line with artificial intelligences? We're pretty sure that we don't want the subroutines controlling the spark plugs in your car engine to be considered legal persons. Well, there's a difference in degree between that and what we might describe as full-fledged artificial intelligence. But there's a difference in kind between us and both of those things. So until we can come up with some actual definition for what artificial intelligence is and means, and honestly, I'm a pessimist. I don't think we're ever going to do that. There's just no way that that non-human intelligences that are mechanical or software in nature are ever going to be recognized as having rights.
I would say rather than pessimistic, that might actually be a brighter outlook, because the kind of future that I fear when it comes to these things is where non-human intelligence actually becomes sentient, becomes conscious, and perfect example. I mean, science fiction is full of examples like this, and it seems plausible, at least at a at a highly theoretical level. When you get down to to mimicking neuroscience and the function of the brain and the radical parallelism that there is in the computing structures and all that stuff, it seems like, you know, this may never happen. And there's almost good reason to hope that it never does, because think of the suffering that will go on if these beings become conscious, become sentient, the ability to experience emotion and pain and suffering and the existential fears that we all have about death and just life in general. You know, it's if we can't clearly draw that line, and inevitably the process of drawing that line would be imperfect, at least between now and to the point where we get that line, and then I don't think that line could ever be perfectly drawn. There's going to be a suffering, and I don't think the expansion of more suffering in the universe is a good thing. So rather than saying it's pessimistic, Ryan, perhaps we could say that let's just hope it doesn't get that way, and then we can, you know, clearly draw these lines between human and non-intelligent, human and non-human intelligence to not have to worry about. So. Well, I was suggesting a while ago that we shift gears. Why don't we go ahead and do that? Did you guys hear that the House passed CISPA this week? This is the cyber intelligence bill. Either of you guys following that stuff and have any concerns? James, what do you think?
I haven't been following it. Oh, and I just wanted to quickly mention that City of Cleburne was the Supreme Court case I was trying to think of earlier about the mentally disabled. But yeah, I have been following it. And yeah, it has passed the House, not yet the Senate. And as I understand it, President Obama is still expects to veto it as it stands now. And I think it remains to be seen whether or not it will pass the Senate with enough votes to potentially overcome that veto. So we'll see what comes of the bill as it stands. I think it's very interesting to imagine what the practical effect of the bill will be. You know, in a sense, the main thrust of the bill to do with data sharing between private companies and organizations and the federal government, I mean, you know, gosh, that sounds great. Who wouldn't want people to help law enforcement catch criminals? And, you know, of course, private entities and individuals can always, you know, come help out and share information with the government. There's nothing wrong with that. And generally speaking, it doesn't really bother the Fourth Amendment when it's private organizations voluntarily sharing information, but that doesn't usually trigger the Fourth Amendment when it's done on a voluntary basis. I think some of the concerns that that you have that you mentioned before that it might cause people to be wary of handing any information over to private companies, knowing that it's going to be that much more likely that the government will eventually get its hands on it, probably in a very large data mining kind of way. But I don't know. I don't know if that people will actually have that reaction, because if we take a look at take a page from history, in 1928, the Supreme Court ruled in Olmstead that there was no reasonable expectation, or there was no Fourth Amendment issue, I should say, the reasonable expectation of privacy came later. There was no Fourth Amendment issue with wiretapping. The Fourth Amendment didn't apply to telephone conversations, didn't apply to wiretapping, and the police didn't need a warrant to get a wiretap. That was Olmstead. So from 1928 to 1967, that was the law. And then in 1967, with the Katz case, there was the creation of the reasonable expectation of privacy standard. And then suddenly wiretaps needed a warrant. But from 1928 to 1967, people certainly used telephones. They were pretty popular. I mean, I wasn't alive yet, but as I understand it from, you know, TV and movies and history books, people certainly liked telephones. And I don't seem to I don't seem to recall a lot of people being very careful, thinking, oh, gosh, I'm going to make a phone call, but I better be careful what I say. The police could be listening at any time because, you know, they don't need a warrant. I don't get that impression that that's how people thought about things in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and early 60s. So while CISPA might lead to a lot of government data mining, or at least more and that kind of thing, I don't know if it'll actually lead to people really changing their behavior.
Ryan, what do you think? I mean, is James onto something, pointing to the fact that people weren't afraid to make phone calls in most of the 20th century before there was Fourth Amendment protection, that the courts told us there was a Fourth Amendment interest here? Isn't a bunch of data stored in the cloud a little bit different than, you know, phone calls over party lines in the 1930s? Anything to that? Or is James right in saying that I don't want to put words in James' mouth, so we'll just leave it at that.
I think that I was thinking about this as we're doing the show and some of the reading I've been doing. And something that occurred to me was connected to what we were talking about with Ryan Kahlo, which is the vast majority of us are carrying around GPS devices that are identifiable with the owners. And there's no obvious reason to me that information about the constant position of these things could not be stored somewhere. And if that database existed, CISPA would seem to provide the government with access to it. I see this providing two advantages to law enforcement. One would be identifying potential suspects. I still think that the prophylactic uses are too technically difficult because it's just so much information to be observed all at once that it's easy to pick out the information you need after the fact, but it's almost impossible to do it ahead of time. But with this data in mind, you can narrow down on a specific place at a specific time and say, who was here at this time? And all of a sudden, you now have a list of, 50 suspects instead of the 10,000 people that may have passed through the area at some point that day. You also get a potential list of witnesses, some of whom may actually have documentary evidence of what happened in the form of video or pictures. That's incredibly valuable, both for the criminal justice system and the civil one. There are any number of civil cases where the case could be completely changed by the existence of pictures or video. And in many cases, this stuff probably exists, but the parties have no way of finding out who created it and who has it. So it's as if it never existed at all. So those are the issues that I was thinking about as we were talking about the Boston situation. Saying, oh, yeah, CISPA is coming into play here. There's the potential for an enormous database of GPS movements that this could turn over to the authorities.
You know, there was a piece on MSN's website pretty soon after the bombings that was talking about some of the privacy implications here. And Brian Pascal, who is a fellow at Stanford CIS, he may be a colleague of Ryan Kahlo's or has been in the past, I guess, was talking about some of the risk or the privacy concern that perhaps we should have what he characterizes as the secondary usage of information that is collected in the context that Pascal was talking about. Brian Pascal, that is, not to be confused with Blaise Pascal, was talking about, it was, we have all these images taken by each other, little brother, so to speak, all of us using our high resolution cameras on our cell phones. This isn't necessarily Big Brother taking the pictures. And, we turn over this vast data set to the authorities and they use it to mine, finding the guy in the black hat and the white hat and all of that stuff, using it for purposes of this investigation. But then there's this risk that, this data is going to be kept around for a long time, perhaps perpetually. The web means the end of never forgetting. Why not, these data sets meaning the end of never, or the end of forgetting, not the end of never forgetting, but the end of forgetting. So, Brian Pascal's examples, to add a little more detail, what about the picture of the guy smoking marijuana in one of these photos? I don't know, many people why would you use a dugout or something, while you're standing on the street corner there in Boston, but what have you? Or, a more simple explanation would be a guy jaywalking, a person jaywalking there, you catch them. And, what's the responsibility that law enforcement has to use that data there? I'm wondering if either one of you would be willing to comment on whether CISPA, truly exacerbates that risk to our civil liberties, to our privacy interests, because if CISPA is enacted, as we've, I guess, only kind of established by implication, what it would mean is that these third-party providers who collect information could turn over to the government with impunity any information that, you know, is the cyber threat information, which is very loosely defined and could mean a number of different things. James, what about you? Would you be willing to comment on that risk of the secondary usage of this information?
Well, yeah, I think it's certainly very, very likely. I think what we've seen with some parts of the law, for example, the census and I believe tax information and a few other things, that there's some parts, some information that people give the government where there are rules, for example, with census information, there are rules that it's confidential, and in fact, it can't be used to the legal detriment of the respondent, except, of course, if it's alleged that you were violating the census laws. So there's some things where the government has specially set up laws where, yes, you have to give us information, but we're very careful to make sure that we won't do anything to hurt you with it, because we really need the information for some very particular purpose. I think another example is that, strictly speaking, you're supposed to pay taxes on drugs like marijuana. And so if you buy marijuana, you're supposed to pay marijuana tax. But the quid pro quo for that is that they can't take the fact that you paid your marijuana tax and use it to investigate you for or charge you with the fact that you have possessed marijuana. So there are some things like that. The census example is probably a little better, where the government like takes care to make sure they won't misuse the information. And I think that that points to the fact that in every other case where they don't do that, they will in fact use the information for every imaginable purpose. I think that's exactly what will happen with this kind of data, is that it, to the extent that there are not very careful safeguards on how it gets used and by whom, the result will be that as soon as it's given to the government for one purpose, it will get passed around, and because that's another thing that we're that is considered to be a very important thing that we should do these days, is that government agencies should share information and we shouldn't have silos, and that it's very important that we have clearing houses and unified databases and interagency cooperation and access, that once it's passed to one agency for one purpose, it'll get seen by every agency and used for every purpose. And I think that it's extremely likely that there will be knock-on effects and bystanders get caught up for one thing and another if there are not safeguards. And I think that what we're seeing is that there are not a lot of safeguards in the law. And so, yeah, something – information might get handed over because of a, you know, cyber threat or whatever. But if along the way somebody happens to notice something that is not at all cyber-related, well, the cat's out of the bag. There's no reason not to use the information at that point, right?
Ryan, any reaction to that?
Yeah, I think so. I think I share most of James' concerns that once this data is out there and the government has their hands on it, they're going to try and use it. And every branch of the government is going to try and use the information as best they can. But I think that might sort of be where the hitch comes in. We're talking about a vast amount of data. And it's a lot of prosecutors' offices are already swamped with a volume of information that they've got to deal with as it is. You know, increasing that by two orders of magnitude with these electronic databases isn't going to help them solve the problem of how to sift through all of this stuff to find what they're looking for. And yeah, big data and data mining have some promise in solving that solution or furthering that problem, depending on how you think about it. But it isn't just the problem of false positives, but also the problem of false negatives. We'll see some stuff that's not there, and we'll miss some stuff that is. Mm-hmm. Certain kinds of data we're pretty good at handling. Other kinds we're just not. And if it's things like surveillance footage or even things like GPS location, the fact that this data exists doesn't necessarily mean that we can do anything useful with it just yet. So, again, I think that this is a problem and that we need to think carefully about it. But I think there are some real technical issues here, and even just manpower issues that may mitigate some of these bad effects, at least for a little while.
All right. Which one of you guys wrote about the New York City ban on superhero costumes in public places? Which one is that on Law in the Multiverse?
That was mostly my post there.
Yeah. What's that all about? What are those bills? What do those bills say? What's the concern here?
I have to be honest. I have not read the text of the proposed language. I'm not even sure that there is much of it. What I saw was a news item saying that a New York City councilman is proposing a regulation or an outright ban of costume characters related to some of the bizarre and unpleasant incidents that they've had with people dressed up, especially as Sesame Street characters, but other characters as well. There was this sort of anti-Semitic Elmo in Central Park. And I think a small child was assaulted by a different person wearing a Sesame Street character costume in Times Square. And he just thought that this, the councilman thought this was completely unacceptable and is proposing some way of controlling this. And my first thought, I had sort of two immediate thoughts. The first one was, there's probably some First Amendment issues here. The other one was, wait a minute, superheroes are going around in costumes. This seems to be a real world law that might affect some of the fictional stories that we write about. That's at least worth a post. The two proposals that he's put forward, I think they're alternatives. One seems to be an outright ban on the wearing of costumes in public places. I think that's problematic. The Supreme Court has recognized that the wearing of clothing and costumes is at least potentially expressive conduct under the First Amendment. So completely banning it may not be constitutional. His other suggestion was to regulate this activity. And I think this is more plausible. Regulations that just outright ban speech are heavily disfavored by the courts. But regulations that target, that impose content neutral regulations on the time, place, and manner of expression are easier to get through. So if you said you're not allowed to wear costumes while you're panhandling, they could probably do that. Or they could say, if you're going to wear costumes in a public place, you have to register. Maybe they can do that. That might look a little bit like prior restraint, which the courts don't like. But if they targeted at specific areas, so like, you know, you have to register to wear a costume in Central Park or in Times Square, that's looking a little more plausible. The other thing that he proposed was requiring anyone wearing a costume character to carry on their person evidence that they have permission from the person or persons that created this character to wear this costume. I think this is problematic, and James may have more to say here, because now we're talking about sort of state implementation and enforcement of copyright laws, and copyright is exclusively federal. Congress has completely occupied that field of regulation, and the states and local governments are really not going to be able to do much to enforce copyright. So all of those things are sort of in the post. And then there's the related issue of, you know, how would this affect Spider-Man? You know, the Fantastic Four are public figures that regularly go around in costume. You know, what's a costume? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I've been to New York. I've been to Brooklyn and Lower East Side. people wear stuff. What's to say this is a costume and that's not just, you know, going out to a bar? And if they tried to solve that issue by specifically targeting it to pre-existing character costumes, now we run back into the copyright problem. And the states aren't really allowed to try and add extra regulations there. So I just thought that this was an interesting issue to talk about on the blog.
What do you think, James? Any reaction to that?
excuse me. There was a Supreme Court case several years ago, Bonito Boats, that was sort of dealing with patents, but the patent and copyright clause is all of a piece in the Constitution, that held that not only can the states not try to do their own state patent or copyright law, they can't even do anything similar. The issue in that case had to do with a California law that tried to protect boat hull designs, the designs of boat hulls. The court said, no, that's too close to something that's kind of vaguely like a patent. And so they struck it down under this the supremacy clause. The preemption aspect is under preemption. And I think that this might very well run into that same issue. It could possibly be justified under more of a state trademark basis. They could say, oh, no, this isn't copyright or even federal trademark. What we're trying to do is we're trying to say if you have a New York state trademark and we're on this character, then we're trying to help you enforce that state trademark. But that might even have problems because it's a New York City bill that they're trying to do. And who knows? I don't know about how the separation of powers or whatever between sort of state federalism issues in New York between the state government and the local governments. That could definitely be an issue with even the that sort of narrower regulation approach. So pretty much however they try to slice it, it could be tricky to actually accomplish this. I think it might be simpler for them to just keep a closer eye on the panhandlers in Times Square rather than trying to pass some really difficult to define bill telling people what they can and can't wear in New York.
Right. And to go along with that, these panhandlers were already doing things that were illegal. You know, it turns out assaulting 8-year-old boys, you can already be arrested for that. You don't need any kind of extra regulation to say, oh, and it's especially bad if you do it while wearing an Elmo costume. Well, whatever, man. The assault is the main problem here.
Right. Yeah. It might aggravate it a little bit, but not in a legal sense, perhaps. So good. All right. Well, we're about ready to finish up here. And as listeners and viewers of the show know, we finish up each episode with a tip of the week and a resource of the week. A couple of tips this week. I don't know if you guys, James and Ryan, you took a look at this in our show notes to prepare for today. But there was this guy out in Hawaii who was having a good time and was driving around in his car, filming himself drinking beer. And kind of, I don't know really what he was saying, kind of going out with a renegade attitude. And it turns out he posted that video of himself online, and the cops showed up, I think, a matter of weeks later. Certainly a sufficient amount of time later for the alcohol to get out of his system. And he was arrested for drinking and driving. Did you guys take a look at this article? Any reactions? Any reason that you wouldn't join in having one of the tips of the week being don't post videos of yourself drinking and driving? James, did you take a look at that?
So I would definitely agree. Do not film yourself committing crimes. I feel pretty good saying that after 3 years of law school, I think I feel good about that one.
Ryan, were you concerned at all about the evidentiary issues? If there was no breathalyzer test, no real evidence that was actually alcohol or anything like that, anything to be concerned about with that?
Well, one assumes that the video was not the only evidence that they had. Presumably, they were able to line up some witnesses as well. But that video certainly sent them on the right track. And the fact that it's posted out on the internet means that there's really no Fourth Amendment issues in terms of needing a warrant or expectations of privacy. It's out there. He made it public. Right. So, yeah, don't film yourself committing crimes. And should you be tempted to do that, don't post them on the internet.
I've brought it up on the show before, you know, this case of a guy who was he was on probation and he got sent back to jail for violating the terms of his probation. Two of his conditions of probation were no alcohol and no using the internet. And guess what piece of evidence they used to revoke his probation? It was a picture of himself on MySpace drinking beer. So talk about killing two birds with one stone. That's you can definitely shoot yourself in the foot, so to speak, with that. And the other tip of the week is get divorced before you get married again, or at least keep your wives separate off of Facebook or separate on Facebook. This is a story. I don't even know where this came from. I don't know which state. But long story short, this guy, had left his wife, first wife in Washington, and the guy was arrested for bigamy. And, you know, he and his wife had separated in 2009, and he purportedly got married again. And the way that he found out here was that his new wife found out and actually friended his previous wife through the People You May Know feature on Facebook. So talk about social media kind of betraying someone in this situation. Either of you guys had any problems like this, keeping your personal life straight on social media, James?
No, I don't. And I also try pretty hard not to overshare. But yeah, bigamy is definitely a thing, and also there aren't a lot of good defenses to bigamy. It's kind of a strict liability kind of thing for the most part. Like, you just kind of have to not be married if you're going to get married again.
Ryan, is James to be believed? Because he seems so, you know, put together and everything. Is he really kind of wild and betrays himself on social media like this?
No, I think he's pretty much shooting straight there. Basic tip here would be, you know, unfriend your exes. I mean, seriously? There's no good reason for this. None.
No. All right. Resources of the week. The first of which is, if you're so inclined to be against CISPA, it's really more important than ever now to let your senators know. It passed the House this week, and the EFF has a really good tool that automates the process of informing your legislators that CISPA is a bad idea. If you go to this is a shortened URL. If you go to e74.us/vf, that will take you to the EFF's tool that makes it very easy. You just enter in your zip code. And it comes up with this wizard, so to speak, so that you can easily communicate with your representatives, letting them know that CISPA is bad, okay, and that that your senators should vote against it. So go take a look at that, and if you don't like CISPA, let them know in Washington. The final resource of the week is Law in the Multiverse, the book by that James and Ryan have written. Tell us about, can you give us the elevator pitch on that book? James, what's the book all about, and where can you find it, and what's in it?
Yeah, the Law of Superheroes is, kind of an expanded, revised, updated, and illustrated version of what kind of the same stuff we talk about on the blog. The blog, for the most part, does not really have pictures or anything, but on the in the book, we do have examples, taken from Marvel and DC Comics, showing kind of what we're talking about in the book. which can be pretty helpful because occasionally we talk about some relatively obscure comics, which can be nice. And it's available all over the place, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the iTunes bookstore, you name it, both as a hardcover and electronically.
Great, great. And, well, we're about ready to finish up. We need another MCLE passphrase. For those of you who are trying to get MCLE credit, let's just make that multiverse. Multiverse is the second MCLE passphrase. So really fun conversation, guys. Really, really have enjoyed it. Ryan, what do you have going on? Anything you want to plug besides the book? You have any speaking gigs? Anything new and exciting going on in the near future?
I will be presenting at the Mensa Regional Gathering in Washington, D.C. next month. I'll be giving the keynote address. That is on May 18th. Those of you who know what that is can look it up there. I'm not sure I have a web address for you, but that's my next speaking engagement.
James, what about you? What's new and going on in the near future?
I'm actually in Arkansas today and tomorrow. Tomorrow I'm going to be speaking at the Arkansas Literary Festival, giving a talk, doing a panel discussion with Travis Langley, a professor and author of a book about the Batman and psychology.
Very cool. All right. Everybody check out, what's the URL? Is it lawinthemultiverse.com?
Yep.
Is that right? And are you guys on the Twitter?
Yes, we are Law AT Multiverse on Twitter.
Very good. Very good. Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation. A lot of fun today. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, everybody in IRC. Next week, Denise will be back, and so you know, we'll have a good time as well then. But thanks also to Ryan Kahlo, who jumped off you know, earlier in the show. James and Ryan, thank you very much. And everybody, we'll see you again this time next week for episode 208. That is a wrap on episode 207 of This Week in Law. Thank you.